This is Sam Robson. Today's date is May 6th, 2016, and we're here at CDC's Roybal campus audio recording studio. And I'm here with the wonderful Sarah Bennett and Mr. John Redd. And we're just here to talk further. We've done individual interviews before, but about their experiences being in Sierra Leone together for the Ebola response. So I'm going to quickly shove the mic over in John's direction here. And
right here.
Okay. And yeah, so just feel free to talk about, maybe a good starting point might be when you guys met each other.
Do you remember when we met each other?
I was going to ask you.
I don't actually remember when we. I'm trying to think when you were. When did you first come to?
I got there. I think it was September 14th. It was right, basically right before the house to house.
You got there on September 14th.
Yeah.
Okay, so I was still there. I can't remember that, actually. Wow. September. I thought it was much later that you first came.
No, I was
so
there. I was
there?
I was in the second group that went to Bombali. So.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That's probably why I don't remember so much, because you were immediately deployed out.
Yeah, it was crazy. I got in very, very late at night, you know, early in the morning.
Well, yeah, because the only flights coming in were like in the middle of the night.
It literally was like 2 a.m. and
you
it
got
was,
to the hotel at 7
black.
Just in time to start working.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
It was terrible. I had my first meeting at 7 a.m.
Yeah. And I got in and it was like 3 a.m. and I was jet lagged. I'd been through Morocco and the whole thing. And then they said, well, first meeting's at 7. And I didn't know where I was going to go, you know, what they had planned for me or anything, which was fine. That didn't bug me. So I probably met you that morning, I bet.
That, like, September for me is like a really big blur. Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of really big things happening in September, because the house to house campaign was one, the home care issues were starting to be discussed, where to like manage all those patients that didn't have space in isolation units. The
that's what I lived. ETU. I lived that every day. Yeah, up there.
It was pretty rough experience. Mm-hmm. Wow, that was your first deployment.
Yeah. I was only in Freetown, I don't know, maybe, it's probably 24 hours.
I was going to say like an hour.
Yeah.
And then they were like, your way.
I think I had one night in the hotel. And then I left very early the next morning.
Did you get to experience the 4:30 a.m. Fire alarm?
Yes.
At the hotel? It was terrible.
What is this?
Every single morning for like 2 weeks straight, the fire alarm would go off at 4:30 in the morning. And there weren't that many people in the hotel, so they had everybody in one wing of one floor. And the fire alarm is really funny, because it's this like British man who says something in British, like, this is an emergency, please leave the building.
It's an emergency.
And, and in an accent. And of course, like, you're not entirely sure if you're dreaming that. And I wouldn't mind dreaming a British voice, like, speaking into my ear. But you almost, like, miss it. And he only says it twice. And so you're kind of, like, disoriented. You kind of wait. And then you start hearing doors slamming in the hallway. And then you, like, you look out the door and you see, like, your colleagues in their pajamas and their bath towels and their bathrobes, like, exiting the building. And it was raining in September, so you'd go outside and it's pouring rain.
I had
rain.
Just gotten there, you know, I was incredibly jet lagged, and the fire alarm went off, and I thought, well, we're supposed to go outside. You know, I did all the training, you know, I'll go ahead.
Leave when there's a fire drill, or a fire alarm. And the funny thing about it was, like, all the time that the unit was being evacuated, like, the hotel staff were running around like, no, it's fine, go back to your rooms. And you're like, are you sure it's fine? Like, nowhere else in this building there's a fire? Because most of the building is empty.
Yeah.
So, like, how, you know, it was one of those really weird, quirky things that happened for 2 weeks straight. It was miserable.
So at some point, do you just sit through it?
No, I think most people got up and evacuated.
One of them's going to be.
People met a lot
someday.
Of interesting people that way, because as the as they were coming up to the house to house campaign, a lot of companies that were still in country, like the mining companies and other NGOs, were putting their staff up in the hotel. And so, like, one of our EIS officers was staying across the hall from two guys that owned one of the diamond mines, and I was like, in the middle of your evacuation, you hit them up for money. That's what you're supposed to be doing. That's why we have these 4:30 in the morning drills.
So how long had you been there at that point?
I got to country at the end of August, like the 28th or something of August. So just a couple of weeks.
Oh, so we were largely same vintage.
Yeah.
But we had different jobs.
It's weird.
I mean, we're both medical officers. That actually sort of somewhat similar.
They kept sending me back and forth to Kenema to try to help out there as best I could. But and so then if you went to Bombali, we probably didn't overlap at all.
Yep.
Because who did you were you the first? You were the first. No, you followed Ruth.
I was the second.
That's
correct.
Yeah.
But honestly, they had seen hardly any cases, and
right, they were getting prepared.
Right.
They were setting up all the surveillance.
There was preparation, right? So they, when I got there, they had set up the VHF, the viral hemorrhagic fever database, and it was barely going. But when Bridget and I showed up, there was a backlog of, I don't know, probably 200 or more case investigation forms.
Were you there when they were setting up like Arab Hospital and paramedical?
Oh, yes.
Three holding units.
Right. There were three holding centers.
And were you there when the, was it Al Jazeera had gone out and done that really tough story on, was it paramedical hospital, where the patients were just basically like left?
Yeah. I got to go, I didn't get into any holding centers other than that, but I was able to go through paramedical before they opened it. Arab Hospital before they opened it.
Yeah.
And then I spent loads and loads of time at both the government hospital. And then also, I went to the holding centers all the time.
Yeah, the hospital. that was a definitely difficult place to work.
Very hard.
But
I was able to. It was very interesting because, of course, once they opened the holding centers, unless you were going to put on PPE, which we were supposed to avoid, unless, of course, it was.
Yeah, because you'd get in trouble with me.
Yeah. I didn't want
to
go.
Basically, like, if anybody put on PPE, I was supposed to be notified, and then I was supposed to sort out whether you had to be whisked out of country because of an exposure. Although I'm the only one probably on the team. Me, myself, and Kevin Clark were probably the only two who ended up putting on PPE.
For the driver?
Yeah, there was
a driver who got ill. Yeah.
Yeah.
He didn't have Ebola, but.
He didn't have Ebola, but he still passed away, which is, the terrible thing in all of this is that people died from so many other things because they weren't getting care and they didn't have Ebola. But you certainly were worried about it until you got a death swab back, which took some time.
Because
I think you were involved in trying to track that death swab down.
I spent about a day and a half trying to find that.
Yeah, and I think it was
swab.
Like 5 days before we finally tracked it down because it wasn't clear like where the swab had gone to, where it was collected, why it went all the way to Waterloo Cemetery.
It went to the Italian lab, right?
I think in the end, that's where we found it. But I think somebody on the WHO team, started like going around trying to track it down. Crazy how difficult that was.
Lots of it was difficult.
Well, I can't remember actually when paramedical and Arab and all of those facilities closed. Do you remember when they closed? Because they weren't open, I don't think, for very long.
Probably December, I think, around there.
And then Matene ETUs opened.
When they opened, right.
Okay, and then they didn't need the holding units anymore.
But, when I first got there, it was unbelievable. I mean, those holding centers were just opening up, and the cases were really starting to take off. In fact, the house to house actually was very effective at case finding.
Right, there was a little bump
really,
in the heavy curve.
Really, and we saw that in Bombali also.
Well, I mean, you needed someplace in Bombali because the drive to Kenema was so difficult.
Right.
Because they would take them down, and then it was a several hour drive, I think, to get, even though they're very close on the map, there's no. Like direct,
no direct route,
no direct route, and so you're on terrible roads
hours.
Through Tonkalili district, and then it's terrible.
Down through Tonkalili, and the labs had to go to a different place. They went to Bo, to the CDC lab in Bo.
Did they at that time? I didn't think
they did. Bo had just opened up because I every night
all this.
every night I would talk to John Towner, who was there, to Dr. Towner.
Oh, he was the one that actually moved the lab.
Yep.
Yeah. So wow. And yeah, because the lab was sitting in the Kenema Government Hospital, and that space was really not a safe space because of what was going on at Kenema. And So I guess you guys were sending patients. I think actually one, somebody called me because Kanema got like a truckload or an ambulance load of patients from Bombolee. And I guess the Bombolee DMO had been told not to send them because Kanema was full and the DMO and Bombolee sent them anyway. And so then they were dropped off in the parking lot of the Kanema Government Hospital. And our team like walked in the next day and found them just kind of like milling around the general wards and the parking lot and it, like in front of the ETU. One, I think, had gone into the pediatrics ward and like just took a bed there.
Wow. We used to send patients to either Kailan or Kanema, basically. Yeah. Those were the only
choices ETUs at
for
the
us in those days.
Well, for the whole country. So like, so the other problem was coordination. So you'd have Freetown and its hospitals just shipping all their patients to Kanema and Kailan. But you had that coming from all the other districts as well. And there was no sort of centralized, basically triage system to try to figure out which patients from where go to which facility. And since there were only two of them, DMOs just made the, like, we'll send them to Kailan today. We'll send them to Kanema today. And it was just terrible for the ETU staff.
Is that something that got, like, addressed, the fact, the chaos of that?
So, I mean, we needed more beds.
Right.
And that's the case management stuff I spent a lot of time working on, was going to meetings.
Right.
So the case management pillar had started up during, at the very beginning of the outbreak, like May, I guess, right after the first like confirmed cases in May, and had continued to meet, I think, until like mid-June, late June. And a lot of the work then was focused on getting the hospitals prepared to potentially isolate cases. There was some, MSF came in and put the two facilities in Kailan and Kanema, but most people didn't think the outbreak was going to get as out of control, and almost everybody was convinced it would not spread to Freetown, or at least there was denial about spread
to Freetown. I think it was definitely denial.
Because when there were cases in Freetown, people were like, they're not in Freetown, or if they're in Freetown, they're in the poor areas of Freetown, they've come from somewhere else, this is not a problem for Freetown.
Yeah, it's really true that people...
Yeah, and so so there was just this like... I think we were it was very slow to get new facilities up and running in partly because it's very expensive. The other problem is that MSF had reached their capacity to open new facilities, and the NGOs, I think, were really afraid to take that on. Definitely a high risk, high liability, very difficult
risk
task
for their staff.
And actually, at one of those meetings was when MSF reported 4 infections in their workers at the Bow when they were opening up the Bow facility, or just after it had opened. And so it didn't help NGOs want to take on ETU care. And I remember actually one of the most difficult meetings I ever went to was the meeting where the ministry essentially begged partners to get involved in case management. And I remember I was sitting around this like big table. It was held at the WHO at the time because we didn't really have any other meeting space. And like the EOC, the national EOC really hadn't opened, like the physical space had not opened. And then the new, what we call the NERC now, the FINIOC or something like that, it had not been built yet. And so we were meeting in the WHO room, and I just remember like looking around the table, and if we had been standing up in a line, like every NGO would have stepped back and to see who was left stepped forward. It was a really terrible, it was a very, very difficult meeting, and it was unclear how quickly, like DFID had funds for, I think, 5 ETUs in country, 5 100-bed ETUs, and it was just really unclear the timeline for the delivery on those ETUs, partly because it was difficult to coordinate the ministry in selecting sites. Nobody wanted an ETU in their area.
Interesting.
And so a lot of the ETUs that were built were put up in like very difficult to reach, or like a field somewhere,
out of town.
Basically, like undesirable land, I guess, is what, and not always best selected for like the environmental accessibility or the environmental issues that go along with ETU management. So it was. I think we didn't really see an increase in beds until late December and into January, actually, because those ETUs then picked up by other NGOs like Save the Children. I mean, they all did a great job, I think, given that they had no experience in this area. But it was so slow. I just like December, like every day, more than once a day, Oliver Morgan would call me and be like, how many beds do you think we're going to have by the end of the week? And I was like, the same number as 4 hours ago. Yeah. It's just this like obsession with beds.
Well, it was what was needed.
It was definitely what was needed. Yeah. Because you had holding units, which, you know, like that was the local solution to not having ETU beds. And actually, I think there's a lot of discussion about the case fatality rate at ETUs between the different ETUs. Like one has a better case fatality ratio than another. And it's a lot of that probably goes back to the level of care provided in a holding unit. And that by the time you got transferred to an ETU, you are already likely to survive. And because you'd survived 2 weeks in a holding unit where care may not have been as aggressive. So.
Well, you know, on the other end, on the supply end, as it were, of that, up in Bombalee, I mean, we were making true triage decisions.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope it's the only time in my life I have to do something like that. I didn't do it myself, but yeah. I was, you know,
but
I would consult on.
Those are the kinds of things, actually, I think that haunted maybe some of the deployed staff that went out from CDC, because I a lot of them would come back to Freetown and be like, you don't understand what it's like out there to have 25 sick people surprise,
and
it would be
the ambulance.
And it would be a surprise. Like you'd go out to follow up on an alert, like one call, and you'd find 20 people that are ill, and you've got one ambulance with you, and then your vehicle, and maybe like a district vehicle, and that's it. And you've got children, you've got elderly, you've got pregnant women, you've got, and they're none of them are even those with medical backgrounds, I think, are not equipped with training and how to triage. I mean, it's not the same as like trauma triage, which more people are familiar with, but you just got somewhere between mildly ill to very severely ill, and can you do anything for the severely ill? You know, I don't know. So do you send the mildly ill because they may benefit more? It's unclear. I mean,
are there times, John, when you were in that situation? Can you describe a specific like decision you had to make? Some people you saw just in vague terms? You know, there was an older woman versus a young child versus.
Well, it was all types of people, certainly, you know, young and old. And we'd go by every day, and I got to know the nurses very, very well at holding centers. They call them holding centers in Bumbley. And they would, as I say, I wasn't making the decisions myself, but I was consulting on them. And every day, I'll get emotional, but every day we had to decide who was going to be able to go and who wouldn't. And every single day the decision was being made by the team to that some people were so sick that they probably wouldn't make the 4 or 5 hour hot ambulance ride, in which they would not be getting intervenous fluids for the most part. It was an attempt at
giving ORS, but you know, it's difficult to do in the back of an ambulance.
So we'd And they tried, you know, there was an attempt, and I just had immeasurable respect for the local people who were making these decisions, you know, all the time. And there was an attempt to make it sort of first come, first serve. You know, if people were
made the
equivalently
faith
ill,
to try to get
right?
In,
if they were equivalently ill, then you know, it was sort of first come, first serve. But there were triage decisions at either end, either too well to take up a space or already too ill to take up a space.
And sometimes those decisions were also made like at the community level. Like you had people, if you had too many people and not enough ambulances, I mean, you could send more ambulances, but sometimes if you're way out in some of these districts, it's hours before. And they didn't have ambulance services overnight, so everything had to be completed by 6 or 7 o'clock-ish.
Correct.
So that, because it's really dangerous to put on and take off PPE, personal protective equipment, in the field. And you cannot do it in the dark. I mean, it's just really unsafe in the dark, especially when the risk is much higher because you are probably transporting sick Ebola patients,
right,
which was true during like the peak of the epidemic. So you didn't always have the luxury of saying, well, I'll just come get all the rest of these patients. You actually had to make decisions. And yeah, I think, I don't know, that might be something I think in future outbreaks if resources are limited and we know we're going to have issues with case counts, then we might need to equip our staff a little bit better with like how to make those decisions. And I always try to make myself available to people by phone, but the cellular networks are not mm-hmm. easy.
Right.
I was also in like a million meetings in Freetown that aren't, you know, it was just a really, really just challenging.
Yeah. It was one of the times that I was glad I was a little more experienced actually than, I mean, I certainly was very experienced with death. I mean, I'm 53, I've been an internist now for quite a while, I certainly never seen anything like that, but I had been, you know, I was okay fundamentally with being out there sort of on my own, but I really felt, or for people we sent who were PhDs, for example, and
yeah.
certainly most of our jobs being a PhD or an MD is largely equivalent.
Yeah.
But dealing with those settings was different.
There's definitely like I definitely felt like there were moments where I fell back into like, kind of like doctor mode where you were you try a little bit to distance yourself mm-hmm. almost as it's a protective mechanism.
Yes.
And you get a lot of really good training on how to do that when you go through medical school and residency training in the US, but you don't get that when you're, well, you probably don't get that when you're like a PhD epidemiologist. Mm-hmm. And I think, I do feel like I did come off a little bit callous to some of our colleagues just because I was, you know, a little bit like, okay, this, you know, the reality of the situation is that we do not have enough yep. beds, we do not have enough ambulances. You just have to make tough decisions, and if you can't do it, somebody on the team there has to. And
I did the same thing, and largely I was able to, you know, take a decision, as they say yeah. there, make a decision and make a decision and, you know, move on to the next one. But
this is where that home care discussion started to occur, which is mm-hmm. a politically incorrect term in Sierra Leone. First of all, none of us believe that home care for Ebola is the right way to go.
Right.
But, I mean, when you have the house-to-house campaign was a good example of, like, increasing the number of alerts and then not having the appropriate
Absolutely
number of beds
correct.
For isolation.
Yes.
It was also the case in Western District when we had the surge. Like, so they identified additional cases in December, and they had nowhere, we didn't really have enough space to put them in. And so actually there was this big movement to provide counseling to families who were then going to have to isolate somebody who was sick who might have Ebola in their home. And I think we ended up calling it something really generic, like home support and home protection and support.
Yes. But yeah, there was something that was kind of a euphemism for the whole
right,
thing.
Right, for AKA home care.
Yeah.
where, you know, the NGO that actually ended up doing in Western was Goal, mm-hmm. and they hired survivors to basically go out at every single alert call. And they were like, if we're beaten by the ambulance, fine. That person, the right thing happens. That person gets into the ambulance and they go to an isolation unit. But if we beat the ambulance, then we begin the process. And it doesn't matter how long it takes between them beginning and the ambulance arriving. They start that process every single time for every alert. And the survivor then stays to help the family kind of move through the process of managing somebody at home. You know, identifying the single caregiver, equipping them and training them on the PPE that's in the kit. How to mix ORS, give them all the supplies for the ORS mixing, you know, where do you put this person in your home? And in Western, homes are very difficult because they're not, often families are living in like one room, maybe it's partitioned, maybe it's not. It's just really, really challenging.
In all of Bumbalee, when I first got there, it's about 500,000 people in the district. There were two ambulances.
Yeah.
Yeah. The logistics were literally impossible.
There were some things actually about the ingenuity of the local staff that I thought was really great. So there was a infection in an ambulance driver in Tongalili district, and he survived, and he believed that the reason he got infected was that the ambulance that he was driving was an ambulance that had been in Sierra Leone before the outbreak had started. Lots of ambulances came into the system from outside the country, but at the beginning of the outbreak, they were relying on their local vehicles, and they didn't have a complete partitioning between the cab where the driver sits and the patient compartment in the back. And what he had noticed, he actually described very vividly one event about 2 weeks before he got sick, where he he would store his food and water under his seat because it's so hot in Sierra Leone. So you have to keep everything in like shade as much as possible. So he would store it under his seat. And when he went to get one of the bags of water, he noticed that they were kind of wet. And he didn't think anything of it because the bags are kind of leaky. They have these like little 500 ml plastic bags with water in them. So they actually taste kind of gross.
Place. Yeah,
I know. It like tastes like plastic. Yeah. And he just thought nothing of it. But then when like at the end of his shift, he you know, he had started like cleaning out his stuff from under the seat and had realized that the patient's body fluids from the patient compartment had leaked under the wall of the compartment separation. And so then what they did, and actually it was a Bombali team that sorted this out, what they did was they ended up reinforcing the walls by putting up 2x4s and then using like a caulking material to go all, to seal around the edges to keep the fluids from going in and out. And then they devised this like mechanism to test the seal every few days to make sure that the seal was still strong, where they would basically like put like hosed water into the back of the ambulance, and then they would check the front of the ambulance. And you know the ambulance was not meant to be partitioned that way because it had drains in the driver cab, like under the seat. So there was this assumption that, you know, fluids and whatever might move between the two. And so you just have this like, you know, local staff trying to figure out how to fix a problem. I thought it was a really simple solution and available locally without having to bring ambulances in from outside. I mean, it was the best they could do at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, there were a lot of ambulances brought in, and I don't know where they are now because now districts are saying we don't have enough ambulances to transport our pregnant women who need to go to hospitals for delivery. Well, the chlorine was not so great on.
Right. Yeah. It was incredibly. It was corrosive.
Yeah. You'd open up the back doors of ambulances and find like everything in there just completely rusted because the chlorine solution used to clean the backs of the ambulances just was.
Which they were laying on pretty heavy.
Not like washing it off and then not wiping it down. Yeah. And so because you just when you think about it, you're doing ambulance decontamination on a mass production scale. There was a site actually in Western area.
Later on, that was managing
42 ambulances, I think. They had 20 stationed at a firehouse in Freetown and then 20 out at this, like, facility, best I can, I don't know what else to call it, out in, like, the middle of nowhere, Western Rural District. And ambulances, after every patient would just, like, go through this thing. It was, like, just this, like, crazy car wash, hand car wash kind of, like, I don't know, it's so difficult to describe. But you were trying to do decontamination on, like, mass, on a mass scale. I mean, really, when you think about it, it's like totally insane.
Yes.
Household decontamination on a mass scale. I mean, you're talking about hundreds of people, hundreds of houses being decontaminated every day. Ugh, yeah.
Well, that's what really happened in Western. So the first time I was in Bumbley, it was fairly personal. You know, I mean, I saw a lot of the patients and helped manage some of them.
Yeah.
That did I tell you last time about the young man with appendicitis?
I don't think so.
Did I ever tell you about this?
No.
I managed appendicitis with a nurse on a young man who we were sure didn't have Ebola, but we knew that they wouldn't accept him to the
Okay.
So I had
and
I couldn't go into the hot zone, so this nurse would go in and examine the guy, let me know how he was doing, was he eating, you know, and it was crazy. But he survived.
That's right. I think we have a little bit of that in the first one. But we should do it again.
Yeah.
We should do it again.
But it was a little bit of, there are three or four, you know, most of the stories were actually not positive from that era.
Yeah,
but there are a couple that are little bright spots.
No doubt.
That was one of them. How did you end up in case management?
So,
I'm just interested because our training is
technically
no. I mean, our medical and public health training actually is. I mean, you did ID, right?
I'm an internist. Yeah.
Yeah. So you and I we're the same in terms of qualifications.
I mean, if you think about it, though, Ebola doesn't really require complicated case management. So, I mean, really, it's isolation and just keep on top of their fluids.
Yep.
And if you can test for electrolytes, you try to keep on top of those as well. But it's not super complicated. I mean, I think the way I got into it was was more from the like the desire to have more isolation spaces. And so mm-hmm. in order to push that agenda, like we had to start attending the case management pillar meetings. And mm-hmm. And I actually went for infection control. That was like the task I was assigned. But the two are inseparable really from each other.
Right.
And so I ended up getting into the case management space. And I think just, you know, like reasonable people with reasonable clinical backgrounds end up are able, I think, to help with the, you know, we ended up working on guidelines and for the management of patients, both in the holding units or holding centers and the mm-hmm. ETUs, and guidelines for the home protection and support of Ebola patients. Yeah, so that's sort of how I got into it. And then once you got into it, we couldn't get out of it because we often, I mean, oddly, because CDC is not really known for having like long-term deployers, but in this case management and infection control realm, I was like pretty stable presence through the almost the entirety of the outbreak,
so.
Right?
Yeah, right?
And our counterpart at the WHO, they were not, and so they would like rotate it in and out, and so it actually the pillar became kind of dependent, I think, on CDC and their input. And it wasn't just me. There were several others that contributed to that. I mean, there was a lot of, like, work. You know, it got into the ambulance side and the household decontamination. I also sat on the burial pillar for the entirety of that time. And the whole thing, I mean, it's basically management of Ebola patients all the way from, like, getting sick to dying.
Right.
So that's how I got into it. And my first, like, day in Sierra Leone, Tom Kaizek says to me, he's like, you have to go to Kenema. And I was like, what am I going to Kenema for? And he was like, UTA has called and it's really bad out there. So yeah. He basically wanted to make me to make sure that our team was safe at the hospital because the epidemiologist office, the district office, was actually on the hospital grounds. Like basically had to walk between and through yeah. wards to get there. And so it was a pretty risky place for them to be. And then the same with the lab, like there wasn't really a natural way to get there without kind of meandering around. And, you know, you had Ebola patients just being dropped off by other districts by ambulance. So you were never quite certain if you'd round the corner and in front of you would be somebody vomiting. Yeah. So that's how I got into the case management thing.
I've heard that Kenema was really bad and that they had to shut it down even.
The Kenema, there was an ETU in Kenema that was largely run by the WHO and the Ministry of Health. This was co-managed. I think generally co-management, my personal opinion from my experience has been that co-management of Ebola treatment units is not a good idea because there's no one that is nobody is certain of whose responsibility it is to solve problems as they come up. And I think the assumption is that, oh, that's the ministry's problem to solve or that's WHO's problem to solve, and then nobody actually fixes the problems. And the Kenema ETU was problematic because it was put together very quickly. I mean, it was an emergency. There's no fault in that. But it was put inside the government hospital grounds, which I don't think is generally probably... It wasn't a good idea when you had massive numbers of patients. And it was on a hill, and in the rainy season, that just meant like everything washed out of the ETU into like the neighboring hospital grounds, trash, body fluid waste,
yeah.
personal belongings of patients. And it got associated with being a very unsafe place to work. So the staff did not want to go in and out of the unit. And, you know, I don't disagree with their personal opinions on the matter. So there was a infection there while I was there, and an expatriate staff member, and then just following that there was a needle stick injury to an expat staff member there, and I think that was what sort of led to its closure. And then IFRC stood
That's
up
true.
A unit
yeah.
like in the field basically outside of Kenema Town, Kenema City, whatever they call it. And that replaced the government hospital. And then that government hospital unit sort of downsized and became a more like a holding unit inside the hospital, which is probably more appropriate for the time of the outbreak for them. Mm. I think just having, I personally don't really want to see like Ebola treatment units set up in fields like sort of disconnected from hospitals, especially when you only have one probably Ebola case every few weeks or so, because patients who get isolated there who don't have Ebola but are sick with something do not get adequate care. It's not a hospital. It's a place to go to be tested for Ebola, and 2 days later you're sent back to the hospital for care. But by then it might be too late for whatever it is that caused you to present in the first place. And people don't go to hospitals for mild things in Sierra Leone. They only go if there's really no other option and they think they might die. So people show up late for whatever illness they have, and to spend 2 days waiting to get treatment while being tested for Ebola is really, it's just not good for patient care. And so now I think actually the right thing to do is to have these mini isolation units in hospitals so that you can manage the patient with consultation services and pharmacy, like having a pharmacy available with medications in it for what you think they actually have while you're testing them for Ebola.
And, I think, and the laboratory turnaround is much better now.
Yeah,
and, which makes that model
work. And the I think the embedding like rapid diagnostic testing into that, at the regional hospitals they'll probably have Public Health England supported labs that can do PCR testing for Ebola. So there's a lot of things that have come because of the outbreak, I think, that are going to be. Hopefully we'll prevent this from ever happening again. I don't have the energy to do it again. but at the time of the peak of the outbreak, I think having isolation at the government hospital was probably a bad idea. And it really caused a lot of the fear of hospitals that that people without Ebola had. And so nobody was coming for care for other things because it was just deemed a really unsafe place. And you could see that from the outside, right? There's patients milling around. There's an ETU at the entrance. It's just
and that spread around the country. I mean, that was common wisdom spread every place.
Oh yeah, and I still think we're still trying very hard to get that confidence in the healthcare system back. And I think. We want women to deliver in healthcare facilities. We want babies to come in for immunizations and vaccinations. We want people to come for malaria treatment. And I think trying to get, it does seem like some facilities have recovered. I mean, you go and you see, hundreds of mothers and babies like lined up for whatever it is they're there for. But it's actually nice to see that has come back. But unclear yet. I think it's unclear still the full impact on the healthcare system there. And there will probably always be facilities that are always going to be associated with like bad Ebola sort of experiences. Like there was a PHU in Port Loko that had like 25 Ebola patients like just in the compound, and our team just happened upon it. Nobody ever called in an alert. So they were just out doing routine checks of facilities and found this like... I think there will always be sort of be like facilities that people associate with good and bad things during the Ebola outbreak.
True.
I think of Maybella all the time as like a good story.
They were heroic.
Yeah, they were in the wharves, basically,
right.
Moa and Magazine Wharf. They served that population.
And by Susan's Bay.
It's a clinic. I mean, it's tiny. It's not very big. It's like two stories actually, because it's like basically like built up like. In this like very narrow space, almost looks like it was an afterthought facility because it kind of sort of protrudes into the street a little bit, but and then like perches on the edge of the cliff, looking down into the wharf. But they had been in the Moa Wharf. They had been through the Moa Wharf outbreak, and as part of that, they had been enrolled in Ring IPC. And that facility, because they had put down a new road in front of it, they had their isolation space basically torn down by the government road officials. Mm-hmm. And during Moa Wharf, the Concern Worldwide, which was the NGO that was supporting all the PHUs in Western, built them a new isolation space and had done a lot of IPC training as part of the Moa Wharf Ring IPC activity. And so Maybella was the unit that basically picked up and isolated the first one of the first cases in the Magazine Wharf outbreak, and was the reason that we knew there was an outbreak going on in Magazine Wharf. I mean, they also had... probably had some nosocomial transmission during that cluster, because initially there was a pregnant woman that delivered there, subsequently resulted in another woman getting infected. But
a woman came in at term
with
and
Ebola,
delivered and was understandably not suspected at first of having Ebola. I mean, she was.
Yeah, people she came in labor. They,
yeah,
they look like they could. Yeah, they, I mean, course. They kind of. They have abdominal pain. They might be vomiting. They have nausea. Sure. They might have fever. And there's many causes of fever at term labor. So, wasn't picked up. But
what happened with her and her baby?
The baby died. Yeah. And she.
I think she died also.
She died also. I can't remember.
I'm wrong. She lived. She lived. I'm sorry. That's correct.
Yeah, and then the other woman, right, who got infected, was transferred to. No, left, I think, and then ended up getting treatment at Recupa in the outpatient ward for Ebola for like 4 or 5 days, and we were never able to confirm her. But you know, if you go back and look at her, and she did have serology testing done. I think
correct.
That was positive.
Yeah,
so
she was positive.
So we had missed her acute infection, but Recupa ended up taking care of her in their outpatient department. Every day she'd come in and get fluids and ORS, and then she'd go home, and then she'd come in the next day, and it was really eye opening actually, because we went and investigated at Recupa. Recupa had a horrific outbreak in the hospital in October of 2014, where 11 staff were infected, and I can't remember how many died, but it's like half of the staff died, and it was all.
It's a little bit out of downtown Freetown.
Yeah, it's kind of like it's. I think it's the only hospital in Western Rural, if I'm correct, but like it's technically still in Freetown, but anyway, it's this like little tiny hospital in this like very crowded compound, and the medical officer that was there when we went to do the investigation, he was like describing how this patient came in. I mean, the patient was memorable. Like, he didn't even need the chart notes to describe how she came in. And I remember us asking him, so you've just described to us a suspected Ebola case. And he was like, oh, like it just, you could see it on his face. Like, oh crap.
Yeah.
I kind of wonder, actually, if Recupa did not have a nosocomial transmission event, at least to the healthcare staff, because more of them are probably survivors from that October cluster than we know about. Because 11 staff out of, I mean, I don't know what that's, we could probably get the numbers of staff at that facility. But
it was very surprising.
It's a very small facility.
But there was no transmission
at
Recupa.
And we were never able to track down any transmission to other patients from her being in that outpatient department.
We followed the other patients, followed staff. And
yeah.
Didn't find, and we did. We had quite complete records.
Recupa was lovely, actually, to work with. I mean, because we were working with two other hospitals at the same time that were not as easy to work with, and I think partly was, I think, related to how we approached working with Recupa. We engaged their IPC focal person, which is a new thing in Sierra Leone. We did not go in with a. Like accusatory or a punitive. We did not place the staff into hard quarantine, but
right.
Some of them were asked to stay home, some were still allowed to come to work, but they were all contact traced and monitored through the usual system.
But many of them
system.
They weren't placed into quarantine for the most part.
Yeah, and it really I think it changed the way the staff thought about how they would participate in the investigation. And we actually see this in foodborne outbreaks, which is my background. Like, if you are, it's the way you approach a company to get them engaged in the activity, especially if they feel like they're part of the investigation. It I think it really helps you get more information out of people that way. But I do wonder a lot about whether Recupa had a lot more survivors from that October cluster, and that's probably the reason why they didn't get infected. I mean, they even drew blood on her and did laboratory testing in the lab, like blood specimens of this woman. So, and nobody got infected. So, they say they were using PPE, and they were using PPE on the day we arrived to do the investigate the initial investigation, but. You never know. I mean, they describe it. Most people can describe it to you. We actually don't allow them to describe it any longer. We actually ask them to put it on and take it off because it's actually much more telling about whether they are likely to do it.
Yeah.
We're like, please, can you show me where your PPE is so that you make sure they have all the components that they say they use? And then can you show me how you put it on and take it off and where do you put it? And then you follow where they put it to where it's disposed of, like the final disposition of the waste. So there were a lot of problems at Recoup, I think, with a lot. It's just a very, a lot of these like hospitals built 50 to 100 years ago didn't have infectious disease control measures in mind when they put up the buildings. And so, and the urban settings, they're very, very tight spaces. I mean, you're talking like you just don't have any room. So, and they're concrete. It's really like trying to retrofit that to do Ebola isolation is a little bit of a challenge. But Recoup, actually, they're getting there. The holding unit, I think, was sort of set up and kind of took over a little bit of the HIV clinic. But now they want that clinic back because they want to start moving on by providing HIV testing and treatment services. So I think they've closed their holding unit. They're not going to be a site for isolation. They'll eventually get a facility through. Mm-hmm. UNOPS is trying to figure out how they can put a space in there, because actually when you walk in the compound, there's no room. I mean, it's like the compound wall, and then you got like, you got a little tiny courtyard, and then everywhere else it's like pretty much like the building is like up to 2 feet as close to the compound wall. So you'd have to, I don't know, go up? I have no idea.
Add another floor.
Yeah, but you wouldn't put isolation up there, probably.
So when did you two start working together more?
Probably when in Western, because I was always mostly based in Freetown.
Right, and then what happened, so I did the first deployment that we discussed, and I was out in Bumbly, and I only spent in that whole time, I think maybe 3 days in Freetown. I stayed up in Bumbly for the weekends. You know, there was an option of coming down. Sometimes we'd have all hands meetings, so people used to come in, usually just for a day, day and a half. But I stayed up in Bumbly really as much as I could. Yeah. The only time I came down was when Tiffany was coming up to us, and Dan Martin, actually. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know Dan was coming. Actually, I didn't want Tiffany to, she's a female trainee, and I didn't want her to ride by herself. So I came back really to get her.
You're such a dad.
I am. Yeah. I know. I can't help it.
I have this mental image during one of his later deployments. We had a very enthusiastic group of very young, early public health professionals. Pretty much arrived, like 20, 25 of them all at the same time. and they just, you know, they were lovely, but they didn't have a lot of experience. And, you know, this is a great way to get experience. But John had, like, I assigned like 8 of them to John in Western District. And every morning he'd kind of be like, all right, we're heading out. And he'd like head out
the
door. And behind him would be this like string of ducklings. It was just so funny. Yeah. And they all had little backpacks on. I mean, it was just a little bit like kindergarten, you know, like or a mother duck and her hens.
They did a great job.
They did really do a good job. I mean, they were so enthustic, which was what was really nice, and not quite so jaded.
Such a hard job. So that was later. Yeah. That was in would have been in July, most likely, 2015.
Oh yeah, it was definitely July.
Yeah, and that was during the Magazine Wharf cluster that we'd referenced, and Magazine was a close to impossible place to try to control anything. I mean, it's packed. You know, there's not running water.
I remember trying to plan for Tom Frieden's visit down to Magazine.
Yeah, Dr. Frieden came and visited us there.
Nobody wanted to let him go on his own anywhere because he gets himself in trouble.
And he said, I want to go, you know,
into
where it's happening. Yeah, yeah. So we compromised, basically. He went to the upper portion.
Oh, yeah.
To the overlook. Yep.
Not down into the, nitty gritty of the wharf.
And their job was to do house-to-house assessment, and it was on many thousands of people. And we divided up the wharf. You know, this was a technique that we gradually developed over the course of the outbreak. And we didn't use it everywhere, but in places where we judged that it was really likely that our regular contact tracing might have missed someone, might have missed a contact who then converted to a case. So it was really, it's active case search, active case finding. And it was really rigorous.
Social mobilization, really. Yeah, I mean, the whole point is to like mobilize messaging, and
that is the technique that I'm proud that we developed. Actually, that was the teams were truly multidisciplinary. Mm-hmm. So there were social mobilizers, volunteers, some WHO people, MSF, CDC, and
African Union.
Yes, African Union, absolutely, and When I got to Western in January, you know, Western's divided up into wards, like Chicago, I guess. And yeah, Chicago's ward, same principle exactly. And they're fairly small. At least the ones right in urban part Freetown are.
But the surprisingly large number of people in each of those small
very,
wards.
Very large, yeah, geographically small and population
density
large.
Like insane.
And in the Western surge that Sarah mentioned before, it was all about just massive logistics. Yeah. And we, African Union, WHO, and MSF, divided up all of Western area by wards. And those were wards in which all those groups vouched to help supervise, sort of to mind those wards, literally. And but I actually, one strong opinion that I had that was shared with Stefan Huguenet from WHO was that was too formal. Like it was a little bit of it. I could understand mm-hmm. how it had developed because there was a great need for strict organization. But by the time I got there in January, and I wasn't there for the surge. I was there just at the very end of it.
Yeah.
It was obvious that even though the wards were broken up, obviously the risk of Ebola
was not equal everywhere,
and the case burden wasn't equal everywhere. And there was a risk if it was too formal a system of, you know, sort of feeling like, you know, my ward's okay, even if the neighboring one was having trouble.
Yeah.
So we worked out a way to vouch to help each other. So it led to really a nice multidisciplinary approach, and we had very organized social mobilization, which I mean I have to say it was really, I didn't feel like it was fun at the time. I was just going to describe it as fun. I mean I wouldn't, but it was very.
You definitely preferred to be in the nitty gritty of the response stuff, because at that time when we were doing the magazine war, you were supposed to be response lead, which means you're supposed to be going to all the boring meetings and at the national level. And you're like, no, I just need another week in Western.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think at some point I was like, John Red, I am abandoning the response lead post because I can't take it anymore.
Yeah. Sarah like, really covered me.
You have to get out of there.
I was supposed to be the response lead. Yeah. And
the staffing and the personnel and the money and the
movement of people in and out.
Signing people's
money.
Overtime slips. I was just like, I can't do it anymore.
I mean, it was such a big response that there was, you know, it had a bureaucratic aspect that's not a surprise. I mean, so many people coming in and out. That was,
and they were coming so quickly.
Inevitable.
So it was like you never. We actually had to put a please only send people to arrive on Sunday or Monday because like we just can't get that machinery up and running every single day to keep taking in more people and then sending people out. It was just so logistically burdensome on us because, you know, when you get to Freetown, you'd have 4 hours maybe of safety training, mm-hmm. field training, and
briefing
we just didn't have time to do that every
where
day.
Where the cases were and sort of an epi update.
And it was like sucking up the time of like the response lead, the epi lead, the IPC lead, the health promotions team lead. I mean, because all these leads would have to be there to sort of like, hi, I'm Sarah. I'm the infection control lead. And, you know, do a little like song and dance about what you might expect on the IPC team. And, you know, we ended up actually restricting everybody for the most. I mean, there were a few exceptions, but for the most part, almost everybody came in. That was a
and
great job done on this end.
And Sarah was IPC lead, and I at different times was EPI lead.
Yeah.
And then the response.
And sometimes
lead.
We were all three or four leads at the same time. It was just really terrible. Sometimes acting country director. We were just like a.
Yeah.
It was like a. Infielder advantage kind of thing. You
well,
know, like.
You know, during Magazine Wharf. So you and I, sort of together as one amoeba-like organism, were covering Western lead, Epi lead, response lead, and IPC lead, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was terrible.
Yeah. It was terrible.
And Tom Frieden came to visit.
Yes.
And we're just like, oh, I can't take this anymore. But we had Oliver was in country at the time, and you know, because he was transitioning out, and mm-hmm. Sarah Hersey had come in, and she was transitioning in. He was like, how can I help? And I was like, unless you're going to sit down and do this, like, staffing stuff for us, like, that's what I need help with.
And the staffing was super, I mean, at the peak,
it was crazy.
How many people were we keeping track of? Probably 120 or so, I bet, was the peak.
Yeah, including the vaccine.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, thereabouts.
They, I mean, our biggest, actually some of the most annoying issues were things like housing. I mean, where do you put, I mean, if you have a case in Cambia and suddenly like six NGOs, the Ministry of Health, CDC, WHO surge into Cambia District, where the hell does everybody stay?
Yeah. Yep.
We had a lot of disgruntled colleagues who were like, I don't want to share a room with somebody. And I was like, we then said, you won't be sleeping. I don't, I can't magically make rooms appear in right. hotels. But, you know, the quality of some of the hotels was not desirable. I think if you're going to spend, I mean, it's hard. It's, I can't. I don't begrudge people for wanting a comfortable place to go at night because their days are so hard. But, you know, it's also Africa.
We did what we could. Yeah.
We did the best we could. Yeah. I mean, I've been to places that have had worse accommodations in Africa, so I do feel like we tried to do the best we could. I mean, I went to Kenema several times in the early outbreak, and the hotel manager, Sally, she would just assign you to share a bed with somebody. She just did it randomly. Yeah. And you would be like, hello, I'm Sarah. You're Anne. I will be sharing your bed today.
Yeah. Yeah.
No electricity, no running water. No, like.
I remember one young woman, I can't remember who it was, but one of the young women who'd been up in Cambia was coming back through Freetown. So I saw her sort of on the way out, and she said, you know, I was able to deal with it pretty well. Because I kept telling myself, just pretend you're camping.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Actually, there are a few hotels where I would have preferred to just be camping.
Yeah.
some of them were really, really gross.
The Woosung was nice. That's the one in McKinney where I spent
a
lot of time.
Well, you know, you always had to, when you checked in, you always had to ask them to wash the sheets and towels. I don't know.
I may not be quite as effete as you, sir, but
I used to get the, like, Ruth and Alexia, who were there before you, they basically got the Woosung back open again.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the hotels closed down because there were no corporations and mining companies had pretty much shut. And, you know, investors who were building things were not building things anymore, and contractors were not in country any longer. And so a lot of the hotels ended up just kind of closing down. And they were like the first two guests, I think, to really get the Woosung back open again. And it wasn't pretty at the beginning.
Bridget.
And then you moved in.
Bridget and I were the
And then
only
there was
guests.
A point in time where you couldn't even get a room at the Woosung. Yeah. It was so packed, filled with responders. And in Port Loko, what they did was they put together Tent City. The Danes put together this.
I heard that was pretty nice place to stay.
Actually, it was not bad.
Yeah.
There was an outbreak there, but one of the NGOs at one of their expatriate staff got infected with Ebola and was staying at the Tent City. And it's a communal living environment. So you share like dining space, and some people are like, I think there's like a couple beds in each room. Some of the rooms are individuals, but there's like communal bathrooms and communal showers and a lot of opportunity for like basically transmission. And they had a little medical clinic, and he had gone through the medical clinic a couple of times and not picked up as Ebola, and so there were some problems there. But it was a really nice place to stay. Actually, people preferred it to the hotels.
Right.
Although the MJ in Port Loko is pretty good, I have to say. If I had to pick some hotels, but you get the same egg and toast pretty much every single morning. You get really tired of eating in Sierra Leone.
They do eat a lot of eggs. I mean, it's
I thought I would never eat eggs again when I came back to the United States, but I actually surprisingly eat a lot of eggs.
Yeah.
The food and God. So I lost a lot of weight in Sierra Leone. Most people, I think, gained weight partly because there's carb heavy diet.
Yeah, it's all carb. Yeah, very few.
But I think about month number 8, I stopped eating. Like, I just couldn't eat anymore, and there were no more possible ways to like mix and match the foods available to get a different flavor.
Yeah.
And I remember Oliver Morgan looking at my plate one day. He's like, "That's a very weird combination of things." And I was like, "I'm just trying to make
it
interesting. I just want to be interested in eating." Yeah, the thing that was difficult in the outbreak was that, I mean, it shut down the local healthcare system, but it also shut down health resources for our team.
Right.
And one of the really big challenges was that febrile gastroenteritis was so common on our team. I had 2 or 3 people a day calling me with fevers and diarrhea and vomiting.
Sarah's
and
prior expertise in
food
diarrhea haunted her.
Yeah. And, you know, we we were pretty certain that the source was the hotel we were staying in. And, you know, we worked a lot with, we actually, I never thought I'd go on an Ebola outbreak and do food safety inspection.
yeah.
But we did. And actually the hotel was really good about getting it fixed. And we actually saw lots less diarrheal cases after that. But when you think about it, when you have fever and diarrhea and abdominal pain, and some people had joint pain because they had Campylobacter, you meet the case definition for Ebola, and you cannot take them to the U.S. Embassy Health Clinic if they meet the case definition. So even that resource was not available to the vast majority of our staff.
Which would be the normal resource for
minor things. And so we ended up having to figure out, like, how to manage people in country. And they weren't always in Freetown. So if they get sick out in the district, they can't move between districts because there were roadblocks that prevented you from passing if you were ill. Well, they weren't very effective, but, you know, if you did show up there with a fever, you probably would not be allowed to move.
Right.
And so we had to isolate people. I mean, can you imagine being isolated in some of these terrible hotels, like, through the day? I mean, it's 100 degrees.
Yeah. I lived it.
No, it's just awful.
Yep.
And so John and myself and a handful of other staff with clinical backgrounds ended up having to manage people. Yeah.
Sarah did the majority of it.
We had some really tough, I mean, our driver who passed away, and then we had another driver who got Ebola.
Yeah.
We had many, many, many staff with fevers and diarrhea.
We used to joke that the cumulative incidence of diarrhea there is 100%. I mean, you stay there, you know.
Yeah, I did not get a diarrheal illness, but yeah. I did call you once because, well, I texted you. this is really bad. In the middle of the Magazine Wharf outbreak, I was doing some visits, and I was coming back from a meeting with the UNMIR representative, and I was like 10 minutes outside that meeting, and we were coming down the hill on King Harman Road, and I just felt this overwhelming sense to vomit, and I leapt out of the moving vehicle. My driver's like, "What's going on?" Like, I had this driver for like 6 months, so he knew me really well. I like leapt out of the moving vehicle, started vomiting into the gutters. The gutters there are like 6 feet deep and 2 feet wide, but there's just like
rainy season.
But there's like 3 feet of water down there, so it splashed back on me. It was really terrible, and it was in front of King Harman Road Hospital holding unit. And so my driver drove down the street. There's a little turn off just to, like, maybe 20 feet down. He comes running up the street and he's holding my hair back and rubbing my back. And he's just like, "You have to get in the car, Sarah. You have to get in the car because they're going to take you away." And I look up, and like through the fence are the isolation unit staff with their PPE on, just like looking at me like, "Do I need to come out and get her?" And I was like, "John, I just need..." No, it was Ibrahim at the time. I was like, "Ibrahim, I just need 2 more minutes." Continued to vomit for like 2 more minutes. He was like, "I'll buy you a plastic. Don't worry if you vomit in the car. I will clean it up. It's fine. But I don't want you to be taken away." And so he got me back in the car. And then I messaged you. I was like, "If you get an alert about a white girl who's been vomiting in the street, that's me."
And I think I'm okay.
I think I'm okay. Yeah. But then I spent like 3 more days vomiting. It was like over 4th of July and my birthday. It was pretty terrible. Pretty terrible experience.
We had one event in Magazine that was, you know, it's funny in retrospect, right? So as I mentioned, those teams were there, and it was it was so hot.
It's hot in Sierra Leone, and then you go down in this like crowded, congested, no breeze wharf.
Yes, and it was very, very close. And there's an open air fish market there.
Yeah.
There was an open air abattoir. I mean, it was, and so there were a lot of ripe smells. And
in addition to like the smells of the wharf and the water and the people, the bodies that are just there.
It's just so close and hot. And so
old,
of course,
food cooking.
I'll let the person, he'll remain anonymous, but. It's a woman. I was gonna randomize the sex, but no, it's a woman. But
because you're probably gonna mix your pronouns.
Yeah,
if you,
right.
If you
so
do that.
So she was down on. I may not even told you about
you
this.
You did tell me about this because I saw her.
Yeah.
So I was also still sick, and I was like, I just should go lay an eye on her.
So as I said, these teams were, and there were probably eight teams, each of which probably had 10 to 15 people. It would vary a little bit. So there were really a lot of people down on Magazine Wharf who were clearly there looking for Ebola. So, you know, it was easy to tell who was who was an expat and who wasn't, and not just not, and not just because of skin color, but
because there's a lot of responders that were not
But people you know, there were loads of locals, but they would always have T-shirts or you know something identifying them. So this woman had been down on magazine, and it was very, very hot, and then you know you tromp up and down the stairs, and it was really pretty brutal sometimes, and she got up to buy the but bear in mind that you know they're down there asking, you know, does anyone have diarrhea, anyone vomiting, and she got back up and was walking by the fish market and was just sort of
overcome
by the smell and vomited, and that word went around the wharf pretty quickly that she'd been sick. It was incredibly quickly. I mean, they're so, you know, it's a talking culture and the people are so densely packed, and boy, stuff would.
It kind of makes you wonder, actually, the cases that we think we missed in the wharves that kept that transmission sort of percolating along in the wharves. You know, everybody must have known that those cases existed.
Right.
I mean, it's so you can't hide anything in the
wharves. Because we were sure that
you can hide them from us, but you can't hide it from the people of the wharf.
That would have been happening. I mean, these wharf areas from around when it took off in Freetown, maybe December to January, probably. 2014 into 2015, because I can remember the first big event we had is on Hagen Street, and that was in January. So we had cases in the market in Hagen Street, and that's right next to Magazine Wharf. I mean, it's all really, you know, I don't know.
It's like surprisingly
it's like Minneapolis
small area.
St. Paul or something. I mean, it's right, you know, there are these places right next to one another, you know. And so we think, I'd bet that it was just percolating transmission there the whole time.
We had, there was an outbreak of fishermen in the Aberdeen Wharf, which is the wharf that's right across the street from the Radisson Hotel. And the international news media had picked it up because it was kind of, I mean, by that time, like, Ebola was just old news, I guess,
right,
in West Africa. And it had been, you know, the stories were sort of tiresome. And so you didn't see a lot of Ebola stories. But that broke the news internationally because we're like, oh, it's in the neighborhood where all the expat staff are staying. And so we actually ended up getting phone calls from people on our team. Their parents would call CDC, like, is my child going to be safe staying at the Radisson Hotel? And it was really strange because they actually ended up quarantining the wharf, and we were still allowed to pass down the road sort of through the communities that were, you know, in order to, like, reach the restaurant that's at the end of the street, you had to kind of, like, walk through there. And those families, they knew us, like, so well. And, you know, every night you'd have this, like, chit-chat with them, like, and the guards. And it was just a very strange experience.
And you'd walk down the road, and left and right were both
They were on both sides of the road,
yeah.
I mean, actually quarantined up against the wall of, like, the Radisson Hotel and the Family Kingdom Hotel. And it was just a very strange.
I was the Western lead then, so it was very easy to go. It's very convenient to go check on the quarantines and stuff.
You know, yeah, it was like
just walk down the street,
get into your flip-flops and do it on your way back from dinner. I remember, you know, that that area was also affected at the beginning of the outbreak. It had some cases, and then, you know, because of the mandate to bury all death safely, but at the beginning when that mandate first came into effect, there wasn't enough burial teams, and the turnaround time to come pick up bodies was couple days, 3 days. So what they would do is they would, it's really terrible, they would actually put the bodies in front of the Radisson Hotel because it got immediate attention. I mean, to be, I think, as a local person, to be driven to do something like that, I mean,
yeah,
either the fear must have driven that, or the concern about the bylaws, or, I mean, there's just so many things going on at the time. I mean, our staff had to call burial alerts in because there were bodies, like, in front of the Radisson Hotel. Not because they dropped dead there. It was because people placed them there to try to get them attended to. I remember, you weren't there in December, because one of our colleagues, Dick Brostrom, from Hawaii TB team, who came out to work with the burial teams in Western District. I think he came for something else, but I think I might have just taken him for my purposes. And he ended up doing a lot of work with the burial teams in Western District. And there was a lot of work done, I think, to try to make the process of safe burial more dignified, and try to incorporate some of the local traditions into the safe burial practice, because there was a lot of resistance against having eight men come into your house in a spacesuit to collect a body and then bury it in a way that is not traditionally appropriate in a place that you have not selected. And I have this photograph that Dick took that I think really captures like how far the burial teams had come in terms of incorporating that. So there was a death in one of the markets in Freetown. It's a really congested market, and the person had died in the street, and the family was there, and an alert was called in, the burial team went out, and it turns out this was a Muslim man, and they actually got an imam to come to the market to perform a service over the body that's already been prepared by the burial team. So it's like in a white shroud, it was placed in a white shroud, placed in a white body bag, and the imam is like praying in the street, and there's like hundreds of people observing it. And Dick had gotten up on this like really high overlook point, and the family asked him to take a photograph and send the photograph to them. But I have this photo, and it's just this like really moving and compelling photo of like how far the burial teams had come, because there was a team that had worked with the burial teams in September, and at that time it was just terrible. I mean, you'd go to the cemetery and multiple bodies were being placed in the same grave. There were no grave markers. Just digging at the cemetery, they were digging up old graves, so there would be like bones in the soil used to. And so there's just a lot of like, it was very, very messy. And so I think that picture really captures like how far they came.
I was up there in Bombali, and the at that time, and the burial teams there had just started to work. And they were right. We saw them all the time. They would gear up in the morning. It was the room right next to ours, and get in their pickup trucks.
I think one of the big success stories actually is the burial pillar and the consortium that managed the burial teams and the burial fleet. I mean, before the NGOs got involved, it was just overwhelming for the Ministry of Health teams. And nobody could afford, I mean, it's a very risky job that they performed, because bodies are incredibly infectious, and the fluids that are evacuated just prior to death are incredibly infectious. And, you know, you're sending out young men, mostly, who volunteered. They did get paid through a hazard pay system, but it wasn't until, I think, the NGOs came on board and the military got involved in the process that it really got organized and it got structured. And then you had time to actually think about how to incorporate traditional practices to make it more acceptable. And I think, I actually think that's one of the big success stories that really hasn't been clearly documented. It would be great, I think, if I keep encouraging the burial pillar to actually write that story, because there was a story written in September of 2014 where it basically is like, you know, horrific description of what the burial teams were doing, but I think they really took great strides to fix that. And that was a pillar that was always attacked by the others. Like, what you're doing is not dignified. What you're doing is, and you know, I remember Abu Jallo, who was the Sierra Leone Red Cross lead. He was the representative for the burial pillar to like the rest of the pillars, the interpillar coordination team, and then the rest of the EOC. And he would give these like very passionate, like, I know what you think we're doing in this one instance is really undignified, but imagine what we do throughout the entire process. Like, families don't take issue with this thing that you're stuck on. They take issue with the fact that we do it at all. And he would get this like very emotional.
What they were doing was just incredibly difficult.
I also think they were probably the one pillar where I thought they did the best in terms of responding to the needs of their teams, the actual people that were on the teams. Like, they, towards the end of the response, they really agonized over what would happen to these hundreds and hundreds of men and women who were hired for the burial teams, because you don't need burial teams in those. You need some, but you don't need. Some districts had like, you know, I think Western had like 50 teams. Yeah. I mean, it was something ridiculous.
Hundreds
of teams. Each team was like 8 to 12 members. So you're talking hundreds, maybe a couple thousand of people. And they agonized over what they were going to do for them, like when they basically let them go. And I think, you know, they're working on programs. They've set one group of burial team men in Freetown. They've started their own NGO, and Concern Worldwide is mentoring them on how to get there.
Oh, that's cool.
Actually, they ended up, it's funny, Concern was telling me that that this new NGO managed to get their letter from the government. Every NGO has to be registered with the government, and you do it every year. And they had managed to get their letter before Concern Worldwide had gotten there. So she was like, you know, so maybe they don't need to be mentored by us much anymore. But they're, you know, trying to come up with new activities for them to do on a volunteer basis. I think partly because a lot of them found camaraderie in the teamwork, and a lot of them lost connections with their families because they were put out of their homes because of what they did for a living. So,
yeah, they were absolutely heroic.
Yeah,
they did.
And I think healthcare workers are always constantly recognized in Sierra Leone, but I don't feel like the burial team members got the same level of recognition for much of the outbreak. I mean, towards the end, I think the president did recognize them, but.
Is there some part of it which is also a class issue? Like I'm curious.
A lot of the burial team members came from, you know, parts of society that they did not have advanced education. Many of them had not finished secondary school. You know, literacy was a problem. Because I remember, like, the right. data collection component of the burial team activities, you know, required actually, like, basically a surveillance officer to do that activity. And so, yeah, so there was actually, towards the end of it, they had, a lot of the NGOs had done basically like a survey of their burial teams to find out, what do you want to do next? I mean, and a lot of them were like, you know, I just need a small amount of money to start up a business. I want to work with my team. You know, there's a lot of that. And then there's also a lot of needs for, like, PTSD counseling. And there was a lot of psychologists that came in to provide some guidance to the burial pillar as well. And they said, you know, right now all you can do is psychological first aid because they're still in their traumatic event. Until they are no longer burying people, they're still in their traumatic event, and you can't begin that process of evaluating people for PTSD and grieving and all that stuff.
I can't imagine what that would be.
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
I can only imagine what that would be like.
Well, one of the things that we've been trying to advocate for is better mental health in country, partly because the survivors need mental health services, and there is a skeletal structure in Sierra Leone for mental health. There's basically a nurse in each district that does all the mental health diagnosis and counseling, but they're not unable to prescribe medication. And so there's sort of that sort of skeletal structure, but they don't, and there's no, like, more senior mental health specialist in country. So, like, if the nurse doesn't know, there's nobody for her to ask, you know, other than other community health officers or other physicians that may not have good mental health training in their background. So there's a lot of thought that for the survivor support services, that mental health is really necessary. But I also keep advocating, it's not just about the survivors, it's the responders, the survivors, the affected communities. I mean, there's just so many people impacted by the outbreak in different ways. Like, if you might have had a business that didn't survive because of the outbreak. You might have had you know, you might be the only survivor of your entire family.
I was just thinking family structures were disrupted.
Yeah. Mm. So I think mental health is always, like, the bottom of every country's list in terms of things to address, because there are very many things to address in this weak healthcare system. But I think, you know, you don't actually require a lot of inputs and there's not a lot of infrastructure required to address mental health. It's really personnel and human resources capacity building. And so it's like thousands and thousands of responders.
Oh, absolutely.
Local and expatriate that probably could use.
Had traumatic experiences. Yeah.
Yeah, and could probably use. I don't think you require medications for all of them, but, you know, counseling and supportive services. And that would be a nice thing to see, I think.
Wow.
Yeah. And then for, you know, the general population could have mental health issues. So, it's nice to see the country thinking about how to move forward, like, dreaming big, partly because there's a lot of interest. And right now there's a lot of money. So I think there's a lot of big dreams that are being put together by the three countries. Whether those dreams are sort of realistic and sustainable, I think is yet to be determined.
I mean,
yeah, it's nice because in January, everybody was still so down about the outbreak. I mean, it was.
But we're trying very hard to move on to the next phase, you know. But there were so many public health lessons from it, and they were learned by the local resources. So, you know, people have learned about surveillance, about reporting. We're trying to improve vital registration, births and deaths. I mean, all kinds of things that are fundamentals for a good public health system.
The FETP program, I think, will be really, like, training people in epidemiology, like foundations of epidemiology, right. I think will be really, really good for the country. I think the problem with, you know, there's a lot of people who have been taught about Ebola, contact tracing and surveillance, but those are the same techniques that are useful for tuberculosis, for STDs and HIV. And, you know, how do we capitalize on that experience so it's not lost? You know, over time, those skills will be lost. And, you know, like, now is an opportunity to try to.
That's why we're so interested in doing the FETP, the Foreign Epidemiology Training Program.
Yeah.
It's crucial. Nice to tell the CDC people who are going out to supervise the district surveillance officers that, you know, be mindful that the future Minister of Health is in there someplace.
Yeah. They, you know, it's interesting over the course of the outbreak to see how our role has changed, I think, in terms of, you know, response. And, you know, in the beginning, well, I'd say August of 2014 through to maybe like March of 2015, I mean, a lot of our team in the field, they were doing sometimes the jobs of, you know, surveillance officers and contact tracers because there just weren't enough of them to address the need. And then after that, I felt like we were really trying to get our teams to transition into providing technical assistance. Like, you're there to help make sure the machinery is moving, not to actually be the machinery. And so, you know, and we had a little bit more trouble with people who had repeatedly deployed because they were sort of used to it being a certain way and having certain jobs and then trying to, you know, grow them up really into, like, you know, into more technical assistance types of roles. And it was, I think it was a challenge for some more than
others.
For some
people,
yeah. People like, I think the people that really enjoyed their experience, I think they like being down in the nitty gritty weeds. They don't want to be going to the strategic meetings. I mean, I can tell you, these strategic meetings, they suck. They're boring. Everybody's arguing. No decisions are ever made. You know, it's just like, it's one of those, like, nobody wants to go to those meetings.
Yeah, you were right. You had me pegged properly.
It's like, John Redd doesn't want to go to these meetings.
I really, really loved working with the DSOs. They were just wonderful.
Can you talk about some specific
ones? Sure. Well, I've become very, very friendly with a young man named Francis Abu Bayor. We would say B-A-Y-O-R. I mentioned him before.
Yeah.
And but his name locally is pronounced Bio. So, and, you know, they just use the last name. And people would call me Red sometimes, too. I think it's pretty common local practice. But
sometimes easier if you just call me Bennett.
Yeah.
There's too many Sarahs in our lives.
Yeah. People would come into the room and they'd just say, bio, and, looking for him. But I've gotten friendly with him. I spoke at him before. I dealt with literally hundreds of them, I'm sure, of the DSOs. But it was a wonderful relationship because I had so much respect for what they were doing. I mean, they weren't getting paid. Doria was late, I should say. You know, they
sometimes
very late. Yeah, sometimes pay so late that it's as if you weren't getting paid.
Yeah.
But they still stuck with it. It was just incredible. They had to, and it was at personal risk. I mean, true personal risk. And they were all young, and I felt like, I saw the. From top to bottom, their response, and I'm not talking about clinical care, but just in terms of the response, you know, the pure epidemiology, I felt like they bore most of the burden of, because they had to make a lot of decisions all day long, which is what we, which was hard. You know, I mean, and I take nothing away from contact tracers. I mean, all these jobs were very, very difficult, but and the contact tracers had to decide who was ill or not on a given day. But the surveillance officers really had...
That decision meant a lot to the person who was being assessed, right?
Yes.
Because if that contact tracer assessed you as ill, that meant you were going to an isolation unit.
You had to leave, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. And...
you don't want to be that contact tracer.
No. That was tough. And we really encouraged the DSOs to know their neighborhood. I mean, to get out, to...
Just be out there,
just
whether
to be
out
there,
or not, yeah.
One thing that we tried to emphasize was... You know, especially in Western, where, as we said, the machinery had to be, there's so many millions of people that just had the, it had to be somewhat, we would say stovepiped here, you know, where, you know, there was one pillar for just entering data, one pillar for burial management, one pillar for contact tracing, and all that was totally understandable. But out where we were supervising, that we weren't their technical supervisors, but we called it supportive supervision. So we were helping them do their jobs and trying to teach them. We emphasized with the CDC people that we wanted to teach them about how to go through the process. So how to assess someone correctly and how to think, how to think about the problems that were at
critical
hand. And they
thinking.
Did a great job. Yep, they did a great job. Because it wasn't, you know, things like that are not cookbook. You know, I mean, there's a case definition that may
I think actually in some way cookbook. Case management is a little bit more cookbook, right? I mean, you really, it's just, you're supporting the patient until they get better or they die. And it's healthcare workers worked very hard, lots of risks themselves, but yeah, they did not have to go out into the community and make decisions about who, what, where they were going to go.
Whom to refer that day, where, they had to keep track of the labs, which was really challenging. Got hard even what there were so many labs that it got difficult and they juggled a lot of balls, those DSOs. I
went to a conference recently where we were talking about sort of like lessons learned and I started the presentation off. I was like, let's just like reflect before we get too critical on ourselves. But there was like in December, I think it was probably like October through January, where every day in Western they followed between 10 and 15,000 contacts twice a day.
I mean,
when you think about it, you're just like, no wonder there were problems. You know, I mean, that there's no way. It's again, it's like doing it on a mass scale, like a factory level scale. I mean, you're just, and you have to be a little bit rigid in the logistical and management
there
of that,
be
because
systems.
It had to be kind of military like in that everybody had to know what their job was, do their job, report to their supervisor, and then that person knew their job, did their job, reported to their supervisor. I mean, it was very, actually that military like structure I think was really helpful, though.
Very helpful.
The role of the military I think sometimes was detrimental, but
that kind of regimented approach was what was required.
When you had to do it like that, you can't, I don't know how else you would have done it.
Well, sort of this is the same way that we try to train our trainees at CDC, people like Epidemic Intelligence Service officers. I mean, you want to teach them that it's, the big part of it is that it's not actually just all, it's not all cookbook. At the lowest level, you know, really literally person to person.
Yeah. And you know, there are always problems, right? And so to try to get somebody to, people always just want to bring the problems, but they don't actually make any suggestions about the solutions for those problems. And honestly, the solutions are best arrived at by the people who have the problem or people like them who've already solved that problem. And it's just this like constant, I have a problem. And it's like, well, what is your solution to your problem?
I'm only laughing.
Bring solutions.
I'm laughing because we had a rule at the meetings in Western District.
Only
that
to bring solutions.
That you were only allowed to bring a problem if you had a suggested solution.
Well, I mean, then you kind of worry that what are the underlying problems that never got reported? But maybe they weren't. They weren't a problem.
Yeah, but usually the people, the part of the reason for that is that if you, the frontline people, I mean, it didn't mean that their suggested solutions were always accepted or taken.
Right.
but the you know, if you at least hear what the person thinks might be the way to fix it, it gives you insight into the severity of the problem and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I to bring the problem to a room filled with expats who are sort of supervising the process, who some of them may not actually get out into the field to really understand what it's like in the field, they're not the ones that are going to come up with the best solution. So it's always really interesting to see how things were solved. That's one thing. There was a guy from the WHO team, Simon Mardell, who's the clinical management lead for some period of time. I can't even remember when, but he was really driven by trying to understand local solutions to problems inside the ETU. So, for example, you don't have enough nursing staff, and the staff can only go in for short periods of time because of the heat, and they have to go in two at a time. And so maybe you have a shift of, you might have eight nurses total. They can only go in for 45 minutes during their, mm-hmm. you know, and maybe only twice during their entire 8-hour shift. So you have periods of time actually inside the ETU where there is no clinical staff and the patients pretty much have to manage themselves. And if they're too weak to get up and go get ORS, then how do you actually deliver ORS to somebody who's weak and sick? And, you know, even if you put an IV in somebody, you still want them drinking ORS as much as possible. And right. so he was like working with survivors who had been in ETUs to try to figure out how you can get ORS to the patient who might be too weak to stand up and go get it for themselves. Or how do you, you know, one of the ETUs was like, you know, cholera cots actually are really quite useful in this setting. If the patient is too weak to get up, you know, there's a natural hole.
Yes,
they can just go straight into the bucket and we can collect the bucket. And actually cholera latrines were deployed in, which is basically a chair with a hole cut in it. So that each patient could have their own commode, essentially, mm-hmm. cholera commode. And it's just this, like, you know, because they'd had this cholera experience a couple years before yeah. the Ebola outbreak, you know, those kinds of things were fresh in people's minds. And so people had these creative local solutions, I think, to trying to fix some of the really difficult case management stuff that they were doing, again, on a very mass scale.
Yeah.
I thought it was really interesting, I think, to see. And what Simon was kind of focused on was that he was like, we don't have a good forum to share these solutions. You know, people have problem A and solution A was how they solved it. And there's no way to sort of disseminate that information among other clinical staff that might be facing the same problems. So they have to go through the problem solving on their own. It's just really, it's true. I mean, it's not really a good way to, there wasn't really a good way to share learned.
That's always the challenge in a big system like that. I mean, it was so many
yeah.
thousands upon thousands of people.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, we had, every 29 days people did a handoff report.
Right.
I could not possibly read them all.
Yeah.
And they would all come, you know, I couldn't even keep up with the IPC team handoff
right.
reports about District A or District X or your 29 days here and there. And it was just incredibly difficult to help the next person coming in try to figure out how to get up and running in their district. And unfortunately, you were really only able to provide really good supervision to those where, you know, where the risk was the highest, and
mm-hmm.
and many other people had to come in and just kind of figure it out. And so I think I kind of wonder a little bit if some of our staff did not have a good experience because they just were kind of put out there and kind of left to their own devices for a month and then
yeah.
kind of left country. And I don't even remember, you know, don't remember their names. I couldn't tell you what they look like.
There were so many people.
There were just people. Yeah. It's like 1,300, I think,
yeah,
or something.
I had that problem this week at EIS conference.
Oh my God, I get approached and by people that I'm certain I must
know you. No, I have to say, I'm glad to hear you say that because
it's a little bit awkward.
Yeah.
I've gotten hugged by people. I'm not quite sure. I'm assuming you're Sierra Leone, but I just I'm
well,
not.
It's a good guess. But it's a 1,000 people moving in and out, and it's.
Ugh,
it's hard to keep track.
It's challenging.
Can you guys talk a little bit about, as you have been doing, about just being leaders of this thing?
Yeah.
I said something last night that I could repeat. Remember I was telling you about my dad? So my dad's an engineer, and he's retired now, but he owned a die shop, cutting dies, like
yeah.
stainless steel metal. And it wasn't a huge company, but probably maybe 50 people or so at the peak, I suppose. But the principle is that is I really try to live by not asking people to do something that you wouldn't do yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And he's that way. I mean, he could do any job in his shop and would, you know, in a pinch. So that was one principle I really did. Well, we all did, but I'm speaking. I'll say I for this moment, but I had a total respect for what people were doing in the field, and there was a challenge and a balance between what we were talking about before, which is kind of a cylindrical or stovepipe structure, which was absolutely necessary. I mean, you had to have those pillars because especially when things started taking off in Freetown, it was the logistics were key. But at the same time, if you do that, it can be hard to share information. I mean, it had all the risks that are common to systems. And So that was one principle, I would say. The other leadership principle that I had in Bombali, I've done a couple tours on Navy ships with the Public Health Service, and I actually picked up a few things from the Navy. And one was hot wash, which we use at CDC also, but which is where you get it. The principle is that it's supposed to be terse. I mean, truly brief. And if no problems, you say, no problems. Remember the Brits, what I was saying? No points, sir. No points, stop. No points, no points.
If you could understand their
accents. Yeah. But anyway, but it's the same thing. We didn't say no points, but it was the same principle. And the you try to hear from everybody every day. And I don't know, you were the same, but our doors were always open. I mean, 24/7. And, I had many, many people in my hotel rooms at different times. You know, there was a little desk in there. I mean, it was a,
I remember my dad at one point saying something to me over the phone about, aren't you worried about putting all these people out in these like dangerous places? And I was like, well, I am now. And but it wasn't just the Ebola risks. It was the road traffic accidents, the getting sick with, some sort of febrile something, mm-hmm. getting malaria. I mean, we're very lucky. We didn't.
No CDC or got malaria?
Well, we did actually have a couple, but.
Really?
much later.
Oh, later, okay. Yeah.
I'm actually looking at the data now about like what we can learn from our staff illnesses and injuries.
Huh.
The vast majority are febrile gastroenteritis, by far. However, those are not the ones that result in evacuations and requirements for surgery and things like that. So I think for me, I found the most difficult thing was worrying about staff out in the field. And because you're in a leadership position, you have this like duty of care, I think, to make sure that you can do the best you can in terms of staff safety. I mean, there are many instances where there's almost nothing that can be done and you have to just wait, which is a little bit hard to do when you're in Freetown and someone is sick in any wherever district. I thought that was a real challenge. And I think the other thing was, in leadership, trying to model good leadership behavior to our other partners, because there were a lot of young junior leaders from NGOs and Ministry of Health and the WHO, who many didn't have a lot of experience, I think, in a very complex response structure. And so I think, I think CDC sort of had a common understanding that we were supposed to role model good behavior mm-hmm. to our partners. And that goes back to things like, when there's an incident that occurs on your team, to have another partner, like the WHO or another NGO, to assist you in trying to assess what went wrong and what could be done differently, and try to be transparent about, leadership decisions and policy changes that we made. Like, for example, when our driver got Ebola, mm-hmm. we then put very maybe almost a little bit like draconian policies in place to try to protect the safety of our drivers, because they were contract staff. They weren't necessarily CDC staff, but I feel like we had an obligation to ensure their safety because they were doing this job on our behalf. And if they got sick, it put our staff at risk as well. So, we had these, but we wanted to make sure that if we made big changes in our policies, that other organizations were aware, so that they can make the decision to follow the same path or not. And I think that it was not always easy, I think, to be a good leader in that role. I mean, going to some meetings in Freetown, it was very difficult to maintain your composure.
Yeah.
And to behave like a good leader, just because things were so personally intense for a lot of people. And so I got called a bad doctor in a meeting because there was actually one person advocating for placing IVs in people in the street, and his assessment of the situation was that it was the right thing to do. And I actually said, well, it's a dangerous thing to do. You would never put an IV in any patient in a street setting. You might put an IV in a patient at home, like we do in hospice care or other right. settings. But you know, IVs are dangerous in ETUs, which is why there's a lot of resistance at the beginning to using them. So I was basically like called out in a meeting with lots of our partners to be a bad doctor by this one individual. And I was just like, whatever, I'm a good doctor. I'm confident in what I'm, you just have to speak up. I mean, I think you have to be comfortable in those meetings to say, I don't agree. And for the record, and you have to be comfortable doing that as a representative of a U.S. government agency, which is a little harder. It's a hard thing to do.
But it was required. Yeah.
It was required. Yeah. And in most cases, I think, our staff had to make personal choices about how they were going to represent the agency, because there just was not a lot of supervision time to supervise everybody
right.
making those decisions. So I don't know. I think, would you do it all again?
I would absolutely do it again, actually. I would.
I would, too.
Yeah, no question.
I hope it's the hardest thing I will ever do in life. I hope so. It was so, so hard sometimes.
Oh, it was by far the most difficult thing I've ever done. I mean, not even close.
One of our colleagues, Charles from Australia. He's got a great accent on our team. Everybody's always like, why do you have all these Brits and Australians on your team? But he asked me in a car one day, we're driving back from investigating the tardy nosocomial outbreak and cluster. And he was like, do you think this is, he's a physician in Australia and he's getting his master's in public health now. And he was like, do you think this is career defining? Because I haven't even gotten my master's degree in public health. And he was like, why would I even continue? I don't think it's career defining. I think it's definitely, it's kind of like what people felt like, every EIS class has something that happens to their class. Like for me, it was Haiti cholera. Mm-hmm. For, the class before me, it was H1N1. There's always something, I think, going on that sort of defines that period of your life. And my epi career might be, because everything I think that comes from that will have something, will in some way be linked back. Either my next job will be because I knew somebody during the response and mm-hmm. then I go on to do other response work, or I don't know what the future holds, but I don't know. I'd do it again.
Yeah.
There were definitely things I wish would be different the next time, but.
What do you wish would be different, like the most?
I think we have some health and safety stuff that we could do better. We didn't have first aid kits when we first arrived. We didn't have an AED when we first mm-hmm. arrived. And you have hundreds of people coming through, and some of our responders were not young. although I do have these thoughts like, I can shock you back to life, but then what do I do with you?
Yeah.
and I can keep shocking you for the 72 hours until the airplane comes to evacuate you. But stuff like that. I did not realize that you are not required by U.S. government employment to have health insurance. And so you're only required overseas to have evacuation insurance. But if you don't have health insurance, you have to pay out of pocket, basically, for all your care that's provided over there. And it can be very expensive to pay out of pocket for that. So I don't know. It's just stuff like small things like that, I think, would be different. I wish would be different.
But overall, actually, very little. I mean, I think because now, looking back, now, obviously, it's come out fine, right? But I think there were there were many times when it seemed as if it was more likely it was going to go poorly.
Yes.
So
there were many moments of hitting the fan.
Yeah, there were times when
splattered all over the room.
it seemed it was, going to be apocalyptic, And so, but what I mean by that is you can't take a good outcome. Well, you can. I mean, and we debrief and talk about what we can do better. That's normal. We need to do that.
Yeah.
But still, we have to remember that we're looking backward on something that I think went extremely, extremely well. Exactly.
No preparation for it. Yeah.
And it could have gone terribly.
Yeah.
And it didn't. So I'm personally, I'm extremely proud of having worked on it.
I think you know, at the very beginning, you were there at the time. We didn't have that many people in Sierra Leone because the U.S. government was really focused on Liberia, and the Brits were supposed to be focusing on Sierra Leone, and the French had Guinea, and we just did not have enough people in Sierra Leone to do anything.
One of our colleagues, his name Reagan. This is apropos at this point, and Reagan was there that fall. That's how I got to know her, and now she's joined the team just as Sarah and I have. I had to, anyway, for some reason I was trolling through my emails. I had to look up an old email, very old, you know, from the fall of
2014. It's so hard to look up old email.
I had something I had to try to find. But in the process, I had come across one that had Reagan and me on it. But at the time, I think there were 5 Epis. Now, this is just on the epidemiology team.
Yeah.
But there were 5 Epis in Sierra Leone. I couldn't believe it. This is early in the response.
Yeah, we were on a call with Tom Frieden doing an update call, and it was John O'Merman and Peter Kilmarks. And I can't remember exactly what was said, but it was basically like Tom Frieden was like, "What the hell are you guys doing in country? The outbreak is getting out of control. It just looks worse and worse every you guys are not doing anything." And I think it was like Peter or John O was like, "Well, frankly, we just don't have enough staff. We don't have any money. Like, what do you expect us to do? We're here witnessing it happen." And I think most of our response was focused on Liberia, and we always, like, in country, we called ourselves the redheaded stepchild.
Yeah.
We were the stepchild of Liberia. And then when Texas happened, I was like, well, now we're the redheaded stepchild. I mean, because, like, you know, so many resources then sent to investigate the Texas Ohio cluster, and you know, it was very frustrating, I think, to see so many people going to Liberia, and you know, at that point in time, it looked like Liberia was starting to get it under control.
Correct.
And in Sierra Leone, it did not look like it was getting under control, and it was starting up in Freetown, and Freetown was starting to get more cases.
When it hit the outskirts, remember when it when it popped up in Waterloo, which is on the way into Freetown and is a junction, and you know, that's when it was just. I mean, there had been cases in Freetown, but when we knew there were ongoing clusters in places like Waterloo, and that's when all of us who were there knew it was only a matter of time till it was.
Those were the meetings where you had this like impending sense of doom, you know, like you just. And I think there's a lot of denial about it at the beginning that it could happen in Freetown. Everybody's like, well, we have better healthcare resources, we have better, stronger district health office, but you know, everybody was just overwhelmed, including in Freetown.
It would not have been possible. I don't think for any country in that situation not to have been overwhelmed. I mean, it was an impossible
right. All roads in Sierra Leone lead to Freetown, and people, and because it's a small country, people travel back and forth pretty much on a daily basis from some of these rural districts to Freetown. I mean, I think districts like Koinedougou and Kono probably didn't have the same sort of explosive outbreaks that the other districts had because they're hard to reach.
They had a couple of flare-ups.
Had like 5 cases total maybe confirmed during the entirety of the outbreak. So, you know, they hard to reach places I think were largely protected, but everywhere else, I mean, the roads in Sierra Leone, the main roads in Sierra Leone are surprisingly quite good. And
they're good, yeah.
I think that if you, I don't know, I mean, there's a lot of thoughts about why the outbreak spread the way it did in Sierra Leone. But it does seem like it, you know, traveled from Kenema Kailaun along the main road to Freetown and then up the main road into Port Loko.
Yep.
Yeah. But all during that time, you had individuals making those little trips and sort of starting the seeds of little nidus type clusters like all over the country. And then you get like sort of getting more and more mass movement along the roads. I think it's different than in Guinea and Liberia. Both of those countries had much more geographically focused outbreaks. But in Sierra Leone, if you look at the map, it's like the whole thing was affected and for the most part heavily affected. Yeah.
I think there were some paradoxes. So part of it was that the roads in Sierra Leone, there are two things. The roads in Sierra Leone are actually are better. I mean, I've never been to Liberia, but I've, you know, seen that on good authority, as you say, Sarah.
You see the photographs of people taking like 3 days to get to their counties in Liberia.
But from the point of view of spread of Ebola, that was actually a relative disadvantage, you know, for Sierra Leone. And then also, Sierra Leone has some large outer districts. It's relatively less concentrated in the capital than Freetown is concentrated in Monrovia.
Yeah.
And I think both of those things made it easy for things to spread out in the farther flung regions of Sierra Leone. And once those clusters started up, particularly in places that, that have relatively large cities like Port Loko or Bombali, and then it really took off. I mean, I remember in Bombali, I mean, there are there are some slums there, and you know, some of Bombali, of course, is wide open spaces, but there are, you know, there are quite densely packed places there.
You I think it'll be interesting for the Koinadugu team, I think, to really describe their outbreak well, because it happened in such a unique district and so late in the outbreak. I mean, Koinadugu was like heralded for its like lack of cases.
Right.
I mean, it was a Washington Post article about it and why they were able to keep Ebola out for so long. I mean, a lot of people thought it was because, you know, they had very restrictive entrance requirements into the district, but all the districts had district quarantine lines to keep people out, basically, and very strict bylaws about who can stay overnight and who can come to visit, and strangers were not acceptable pretty much anywhere. I think it'd be interesting, I think, to try to figure out, like, what do we think happened in Koinadugu? I mean, I think Kono is another interesting district because it was a largely nosocomial outbreak that I think seeded the community, and
I was going to say with some subsequent
and
community spread,
but the spread that happened at that hospital, because the Kono outbreak wasn't like a widespread district outbreak. There were very small clusters, mostly scattered just off the main road getting out of Kono, although the main road getting into Kono is like horrifically bad, but it's terrible even in the dry season. And you know, so the little, you had these like little clusters, like sort of along the road, but the vast majority of cases, I think, were really concentrated right around that hospital. And we talked about this the other day, that probably it seeded the outbreak in Kenema that happened late after Kenema had finished their outbreak, because they were transporting all these cases that happened in Kono at the hospital there to Kenema for isolation.
Because their local facility had been shut down.
Well, they just had the government hospital at that time with the holding unit in
A holding unit, but not a treatment.
Right, and then subsequently, IFRC opened up a treatment unit in Kono.
I stand corrected. It was not shut down. It hadn't opened yet.
And I think it was that outbreak that they made the decision to open very quickly. They retrofitted
and made an ETU quickly.
And then the lab was placed out there very quickly. To try to address that outbreak. But, you know, it never blew up in Kono District.
Right.
Not quite the same as some of the other districts where, like, Bombali was, like, raging epidemic, Port Loko. I don't know. There's some really funny now stories. Like, when you, like, look back on some of this time, like, the meeting in Port Loko at the DHMT about this woman being haunted by her husband's ghost. Because she was now sleeping with someone else, and so the ghost was haunting her and the new sexual partner, and so there was a discussion at the DHMT about digging up the safely buried body, cutting it into pieces, and then setting it on fire to get rid of this person's ghost. And I was just like, I mean, these are happening in a public health, like we're having a public health meeting about this decision to basically get rid of a ghost, and I was like, you just can't make this up. Or the questions about dogs and pigs and chickens, and I think the weirdest question ever asked to me was the risk to manual pit latrine emptiers of through occupational exposure to Ebola, and I was like, worst job.
Yeah, worst. It's
got to be the worst job ever.
Yeah.
That and the ladies cutting granite rocks into granite gravel by hand. That's probably number two worst job in Sierra Leone, 50 feet from the diamond mine. Yeah, Kono was weird because you were out there for the response, and the mining company had given buildings over to the response, and you were like right next to a diamond mine, and there'd be like blasting going on, and so you'd, like, you'd hear this like siren go off, and then suddenly the ground would shake, and then everybody'd be back to like counting cases again. Weird place.
Yeah.
I haven't actually talked with many people about how companies, aside from Firestone in Liberia, reacted to this to Ebola.
Well, you know, in Bombali, I won't remember the company, but there was a. I'll remember it later, but because I met, I'm not sure if he was the president, but one of their representatives. But they owned a lot of land in northern Bombali, and they did the same thing. They donated buildings, and in fact, they paid to convert a couple buildings at the government hospital in Makeni.
There's quite, I'm wondering actually, are they the ones sponsoring the build of there's a new emergency room and radiology maybe suite going in there? I mean, it's massive actually.
Yeah,
really pretty.
That wouldn't surprise me at all.
There were, I don't remember there being tons of private partnerships. I mean, there were some,
not too many.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of discussion about, you know, whether some companies could be helpful in certain ways, like they have transport networks worked out. Like, there was a lot of thought about whether, you know, you could get some like an organization like Coca-Cola or Total Gas, you know, because they send trucks all over the country. Could they transport specimens? Could they transport supplies? Could they, you know, or maybe they could just give advice about how to do it, you know? Mm-hmm. But there wasn't, I don't remember there being tons of private partnerships.
There was
a lot of money donated, like through CDC Foundation, private. But there were a lot of the private large contractors and companies, I think, were mostly shuttered during the peak of the epidemic, and then slowly started coming back online, maybe like March, April of 2015, when the outbreak was largely confined to small geographic clusters. So.
Yeah, so not too much. I mean, if anything,
there's not a lot. Yeah. There's not a lot of private industry in Sierra Leone. I mean, you still have.
There's truly private micro industry. You know, people.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of mining.
But big companies mining and minerals.
And there's, I mean, when you think about it, like the poverty in Sierra Leone is probably some of the worst I think I've seen, and it. I mean, they still, like, people are still farming by hand. Like, you don't see mechanized farming. You don't see, like, large-scale farming. You know, I mean, it's a really, it's like stepping back a couple, maybe a century in many, many places there, although cell phones are pretty prevalent.
Better than where I live, New Mexico.
Yeah, it's trying to call you when you're moving in New Mexico is a real challenge.
Yeah, Sarah and I, if I'm calling Sarah from New Mexico, we'll pine for Sierra Leone just because of the cell phone coverage.
There are things like AfriCell and Airtel did a lot of work on the response. There was a lot, particularly, I think, in the social mobilization sector, like BBC, Action Media, and some of the like local media organizations, plus Airtel, AfriCell. There was a lot of that kind of partnership for the social mobilization piece. And I think, I don't know. I mean, probably on a small scale, like small businesses in small ways contributing to the response by posters and putting things up on their walls. But large companies, I mean, a lot of them are foreign owned and we're just not there.
And we mostly work in a essentially government to government
role
capacity. Yeah.
I think the biggest disappointment for a company was like Air France not flying any longer into country because it just made it so much more difficult.
It was hard to get in and out.
To get people
in and out. Brussels Air had.
Well, that was a real threat. Yeah. So I came in the day that Air France canceled their flights, and they ended up. They were like, keep going to the airport. I got a call like 4 hours before my flight. I was kind of in the middle of like finishing my packing, getting in a taxi. They were like, just go to the airport and we'll have it sorted out. So I get to the airport and they're like, well, we don't have it sorted out, but you're going to get on a flight to Paris. So I got on the flight and they were like, and we'll have it sorted out by the time you arrive in Paris. So I get on the flight to Paris. I get to Paris and I get an email saying, okay, you're going to go through Morocco and you got to find this weird airline called Royal Air Maroc, which is not actually easy to find.
You got there the same way that I did then.
Yeah, I did. It was terrible, actually. And that's when I met David Maples, who I didn't realize was CDC. I knew he was coming, but I didn't know what he looked like. He was actually sitting in the aisle seat across the aisle from me, but we didn't realize we were both CDC until we whipped out our Blackberries in Paris to figure out what our connecting flight was. And then John Myman, an EIS officer from Wisconsin, I think, was also on that flight. And we couldn't figure out how to find the departure gate because it's at the old airport in Paris, and nobody had heard of Royal Air Maroc at the new terminal in Paris. And we couldn't figure out where to get our boarding passes, so we kind of like blew through security with just our official passports. And then finally somebody comes to open up the gate like 6 hours later, and David and I go to her to get like a boarding pass with seat assignments, and she was like, oh, what would you guys like? And we were like, oh, if not too much trouble, we'd both like aisle seats. She's like, well, I'm not sure I can accommodate that request. And we said, okay, well, that's fine, whatever you can do. And we get on the flight, it's like empty, the whole entire flight is empty.
Yeah, I remember it was empty. Yeah.
We couldn't quite understand why it was going to be so hard to get us both aisle seats. Maybe she thought we were together and wanted to sit, you know, across the aisle from each other, which is what she managed to do. But, And then it was like 5 hours in Casablanca, where I met Pierre Roland, who was on his way to Guinea at the time. It was just a really strange experience. Yeah. But then there was a lot of pressure, I think, on Brussels Airlines to keep flying to Sierra Leone, because if they had stopped, you would be left only with Royal Air Maroc, which is the flight that comes in at like 3:30 in the morning. Right. People's bags don't usually come. It's a hot mess.
Yeah.
Kind of way to arrive.
Okay. Well, I know I've talked. This has gone.
Yep. I'm running out of gas.
You're running out of gas a little bit.
Yeah.
Are there any final things you want to remember together? Now that you're here, or any questions you want to ask each other?
No, that's a weird question.
Yeah,
we talk so we talk.
I will go on the record, since this will be on the record, about how much I respect you.
Oh, it's been I really mean
it. It's it was a tough job over there, and I really, really honor and respect you.
Yeah,
what you did.
I am so thankful that it was you and Oliver and Sarah, which would have been nice if we could get all of us in the same room, I think, to reminisce together. But like the shared learning, I think that we were able to do, like, we're going to be better epidemiologists, I think.
We're a hive mind.
The 3/4 musketeers.
Yeah.
It would have been so hard, I think, without you guys. It would have been really challenging.
It's also, it's amazing.
It would still be hard now.
Me.
Yeah.
I mean, I have complete trust in you. I mean, I would trust you with my life. And it's actually kind of sweet and satisfying to have that kind of relationship. And that's why, that's what I mean, that we're, you know, that we're a hive mind.
You asked me the other day for a cheek swab because he thinks that we're like secretly related. I think that's what, I actually do think that sometimes, like, the success of the CDC team in Sierra Leone was because we got along so well, you and me. We worked really well together. And we were at this level, like, comparable level. I mean, Oliver and Sarah, unfortunately,
were a little bit above us.
And we're having to deal with other crap that, you know, we just, you know, unless we were filling in for them, didn't have to put up with most of the time. And so it was reassuring, I think, to have you on the EPI team there, because I didn't have to worry about it, you know? Like,
it was an important thing to be able to take,
to
drop. That's what I mean about being able to trust you so much, because to be able to drop a worry was everything, you know, because there would be another one to...
Right, like you would call me and be like, hey, we got a hospital issue over here. Like, I mean, I think we probably had disagreements, but I can't remember any of them.
Yeah, we had productive disagreements, nothing...
But that's, you know...
That's normal. I mean, that's actually good. I always say, you know, if you're teaching a medical student or something, that if you're... I mean, doctors are used to that, honestly. I mean, you get trained that you're supposed to have... If you're never having any disagreements, you're not actually thinking it through enough. So, disagreements never bothered me.
Well, they don't stick out, so
I can't remember any big ones either. But,
they can't be that important. I think they were just... I think they were just the nature of the stressful, like, environment that we were always under. No, I'm... Gosh. it would have been so different if it hadn't been you.
Yeah, I know.
It's hard to, I mean, I recall the stress, but it's a little like recalling pain.
Yeah, don't remember how bad it was.
I can remember feeling the stress, and sometimes I get flashes of it a little bit, but it is like pain where you don't exactly remember. You remember having the pain, but not the pain per se.
It did take some time, I think, after like the ending of the sort of longer response. You know, we've definitely transitioned over the last maybe
thankfully
8 months, I think, out of this like very intense experience. And it took some time, I think, for that stress memory to kind of dissipate. There are things that stick out for me that are still bad, difficult, you know, but I don't think about them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Only when I'm like reminiscing with other people.
Right.
And now they're not as painful, those memories. And I actually tend to remember more
pain.
The happy or the fulfilling or the, I mean, some of the things that I enjoyed the most was just being on the back patio of the Radisson, like having a drink with, you know, the EIS officers, with you, with Oliver, with, you know, we had a very team oriented.
Very, absolutely. It was a true team.
And you would sit down with, you know, people who are like legendary in public health because they're there and they were reporting to me, which was totally weird. So, you know, you just had this like very, I think, like a common sense of purpose that I don't think I've ever had on that kind of a scale before.
The camaraderie was just incredible.
And that's
actually what I wanted to do my bit, but the camaraderie is what kept me wanting to go back, or that feeling. And it was really I thought very, very highly of the CDC people who deployed. I mean, the Americans really can be proud of the effort that CDC put forth.
We get a lot of like criticism for the 29-day rotations, but for lots of people, that 29 days is a lot of time. You know, they've got spouses, they've got work commitments, they've got educational commitments, they have children, they have pets, you know, plants.
What people were willing to put up with was just incredible, and
to come do something that is completely outside their normal work experience and something that they're largely maybe unprepared for, but most people stepped up. And there were people who had never traveled outside the country before or never thought about traveling outside the country before. I'm thinking of one guy who was up in Cambia who'd pretty much never been outside of West Virginia.
Yeah.
And he loved it.
He did a great job.
It took him a little bit of time. I mean, it always takes a little bit of time for these people to get sorted, right? You know, because it's new, they're stepping into this big machinery, and it's hard to figure out what your place is in that. And for me, it was really easy because I was just there all the time, and I didn't have to have that startup time every single month. But it's just people really, you're right. People really stepped up to do things that were sometimes not easy and very challenging and tiring and stressful. And I think they did a really good job. Some of them were doing it on their own. Like there was nobody else out there but them and their driver.
Yeah. People really brought their best game.
Yeah.
And the effort was monumental.
Yeah. I think for a lot of people, it will be career defining probably in that way. Like, it'll be something that is so different from their career track that, like, it will kind of stick out. I mean, you and I, we enjoy the outbreak response world. It's kind of to our personal detriment. I mean, I think I have gray hair because of my Ebola outbreak response.
Yeah.
I had 4 when I left for Ebola, and now I have a lot more than 4. So I'm... But
I haven't been counting mine for a while, so I can't say.
The worst moment was like Oliver's like, you have to go to Bombalee. They need a gray haired person out there, and I was like, I don't have any gray hair, and he's like, you're getting gray hair.
Oh. That is funny. Is that when you decided to send me?
I don't think you were in country at the time. This was during that last outbreak at the hospital there.
No, but it was. It was an honor to work with the people from CDC.
Yeah.
And I felt, it made me feel patriotic. And believe me, I understand it was very well that it was a multi-country, multi-entity, NGOs, WHO. I mean, I totally get all that. But we were there representing, we're a government agency, and we were there representing the people of the United States. And I was really, proud of everyone.
Yeah.
In the way that they represented the U.S. And I think Americans,
yeah,
I think they are proud of the effort. But it was a very, very good effort that that came out well.
Yeah, it could have gone so many other ways, I think.
Yeah.
I completely agree with that. We, yeah, I don't know. I hope that people had a good experience, and I hope that people learned something. I hope Americans have learned something about the importance of investing in health and public health and surveillance. I'm a little worried, actually, that the transition to the Zika response, because it is a response that directly affects, you know, a disease that probably will be locally transmitted here. You know, I get the shift in focus, but I mean, Zika emerged out of Africa. And we keep forgetting, I think we keep forgetting that lesson, that these new diseases or very old diseases like cholera often are going to keep emerging from these very poor places, and we keep getting behind. And mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing, I think, that if anything comes out of the Ebola outbreak response in West Africa, is that investments will be made in the health and surveillance and public health systems there. But I'm a little worried, actually, that, you know, each event, each new event is coming so much more quickly after the last one, maybe because there's more tension on it,
right,
and there's more interest in not letting it get out of control again. But, you know, I'm just worried that our focus will suddenly will shift. And, you know, countries like Sierra Leone and Liberia and Guinea, that are very poor countries, just won't be able to capitalize, I think, on the on the investments that are needed. Yeah, yeah. I mean, because what they went through was a terrible tragedy. I mean, it's a tragedy, actually. And I don't think, like, history may not judge us well for our lack of attention leading up to the outbreak. Like, we just need to care more about poor countries.
Yeah. Okay. That's a great way to end.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. That's kind of a sobering way to end.
Well, yeah, but it's a great thought. That's forward looking.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And reflective. So
we can get more people doing public health. You know, physicians, doctoral epis, doctoral environmental sanitary. You know, we could just get more people doing public health.
I've got an email in, and I really don't know how he found me, but this is kind of sweet. What's the kid's name?
Everybody's a kid to you.
this person really is a kid. All right. Ebola and other deadly virus prevention. Dr. Red, I'm a student in Downing Middle School, Texas.
Aww.
So I said, sure, I'll call you next week. I have no idea how he got me.
So did I ever tell you about my interview with my middle school alma mater when I came between my two deployments?
Oh.
I had my best friends from growing up. Well, my best friend growing up is married to a middle school teacher who teaches at my middle school, and he was like, and he's a science teacher, and he was like, would you give an interview? And we ended up setting it up by Skype, and I'm thinking it's just with his class, and then 5 minutes before he was like, oh, it's actually going to be broadcast to the whole school. It's like, oh my God. But the first question they asked me was, how had the outbreak changed me?
Wow.
And I thought, what a question from a seventh grader. You know, at that time, I just had no idea how it did. I mean, it was too soon,
sure.
I think, for me to be able to comment on that. But if you had all these great questions about, you know, like the risk, you know, is it a risk to us here in the United States? And, you know, will people travel with Ebola to the U.S.? And I mean, they just had great questions. And I think it's the problem is, you know, it was actually my seventh grade science teacher that changed my course in life. Because otherwise I probably would have been in history or literature or something, you know, like one of the humanities.
You should have told them, listen to your science teacher.
I don't know. I thought it was a really, like, well done. I mean, seventh graders are super smart. I don't remember being that smart in seventh grade, but
I was a goofball.
I was not that interested in science. Yeah. So, I mean, when you think about it, if you go back to like middle school, public health is not, it's like a abstract thing.
Yeah. It's
not a thing that you grow up wanting to be, right? You don't grow up thinking, oh, I'm going to be an epidemiologist.
You weren't Sarah Bennett, girl epidemiologist?
No. Which is why I do think like the programs like the CDC detective camp I mean, I think those are things that
you did it.
I didn't do it, but I'm in the midst of
yeah, it's cool.
I think, you know, I mean, I think those are really great ways to try to expose really young people to the thought, to the concept of public health, because it's kind of this esoteric thing. You know, it's a field of many kinds of individuals. Yeah, it's not like medicine where you have doctors and nurses. It's very multidisciplinary, and it's a little hard to explain exactly what public health is. It's not medicine, which is what most people think of it as. It's just this very nebulous thing, and nobody grows up saying, I'm going to be a public health specialist. You know, you just don't. It's just not what you grow up doing. So, you know, if we can, we certainly could use more EPIs, or at least more health care professionals who think about public health, you know, or try to incorporate that into their practice. So I don't know. I love the CDC Disease Detective Camp.